Live from New York City, it's the Gary Mel Show. And now, your host, Gary Mel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk, of course, about the latest in how to live a long and healthy and prosperous life filled with joy and happiness. We're also going to talk about the science-based medicine or also evidence-based medicine. What's the difference between the two and why should we care and shouldn't we have science-based medicine? I'll explain that in more depth and make it a little easier to understand because I realize it could be a little confusing for most people. It's a little esoteric to what we normally hear. Also today, I will bring on, once again, our Conversations with Remarkable Minds guest, Professor Francis Boyle, and we're going to go in depth about Israel's recent humanitarian crimes against Gazans and Palestinians. How can they be humanitarian? Well, because just an hour ago, signed in as new Secretary of State, Pompeo was just over there and talked about anything that Israel does to protect itself, we're for. There'll be no questions asked. But that's true of every single member of Congress, including Bernie Sanders. They all signed a letter. 100 senators signed a letter. Not one dissented. What does it mean? What does it mean to the future of the Middle East? What does it mean when we call our allies, Saudi Arabia, the number one terrorist training group in the world and financing, a friend in fighting terror? How do you wrap your mind around that construct that we say we're fighting terror and yet we're sponsoring terror? We're bringing democracy and peace and freedom to Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. How did that work out? What did we really bring them? Well, my guest will be talking about that in depth, and he is quite simply one of the finest international law professors. He is the professor of international law at the University of Illinois Law School, a long and distinguished career as an anti-war activist and upholder of human rights. But why am I doing this? We certainly do not have the reach of CNN, MSNBC, Fox, NBC, ABC, CBS, the New York Times. Don't they have their reporters embedded there in the Middle East to tell the stories, to tell the truth? They could. They certainly have the intellect, the education, the wherewithal, and the resources. No, not one of them is telling you anything representing the truth about anything involving the Middle East. We do, and you hear it today. Let's begin. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. And all the information we share comes from mainstream science. And I'll tell you why that's important in a few moments. This is from Ohio State University. And it talks about the good brown fat and why it's important when we exercise. You see, the power of exercise that I discuss almost daily on this program is to boost your metabolism, and that could arise from a fat molecule with an unexpected source. In a study from Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, a lipid, which is a fat released from fat or lipokine produced by brown fat, underlined the term brown fat, was shown to surge in the bloodstream after exercise. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Metabolism. Why is this important? Why should you care? Because brown fat sets itself apart from ordinary white fat in its ability to generate heat. It's what keeps hibernating bears warm, and it is known to be a powerful calorie burner. That's why we call it the good fat. But until 1909, scientists thought brown fat was only in human babies who benefited from its its warming nature, but in recent years, brown fat has been recognized as a small part of adult fat stores and becomes a focus of researchers seeking a better understanding of metabolism. Quote, before this rediscovery of the role of brown fat, we were focusing our efforts on white adipose tissue, the fat most people think of when they think about obesity and ways to improve weight loss. So, here's the takeaway message. When you exercise, you increase your metabolic rate. You're burning more of this brown fat. That heats up your metabolism, which is what you want, especially women in their 30s and 40s, because by your late 30s, depending upon your personal lifestyle choices, whether you've smoked or drank or eaten a good diet or been sedentary, all these cumulative factors come together, and you may be going into perimenopause 5 years earlier than someone who was keeping themselves fit and eating a healthy diet. So your metabolism slows down. How many people right now listening have had that problem that you used to be able to lose weight pretty easily. Now it's much more difficult to lose weight. It seems just to sit there on your body. That's because you haven't been exercising. You haven't been changing your metabolism. But if you exercised on a daily basis, then you would burn more of the brown fat, and that brown fat really heats up your metabolism. Hence, when you are going through menopause, menopause itself and postmenopause, all of those cause your metabolism to go down, down, really down. And that's why the older you get, it is more important than ever before to exercise on a daily basis. That brings your metabolism back up, burns fats all over the body, in which case, then you're in a much healthier place. There has been an attack for a long time on the credibility of acupuncture. Needless to say, we're concerned about the people who not have benefited from it, but would benefit if they were given unbiased information. So within the next 3 weeks, we'll be doing an in-depth original report, which we will publish on acupuncture, the science behind it. But for today, one more study, the University of York, researchers have found evidence that acupuncture could help people who experience dental anxiety. Now, most people understand dental anxiety affects up to 30% of the adult population worldwide, and people can experience nausea, difficulty breathing, and dizziness just at the thought of going to the dentist. Well, reasons behind dental anxiety can be various, such as fear of pain, fear of needles, the anesthetic side effects. So, in the review of 6 trials with 800 patients, researchers used a point scale to measure anxiety, and studies show that anxiety reduced by 8 points when dental patients were given acupuncture for treatment. So, that's good. Acupuncture is easy to get, it's inexpensive, it's safe, and it can help alleviate anxiety. This was published in the European Journal of Integrative Medicine. Some athletes now are on this kick of using a keto, ketogenic, G-E-N-I-C, ketogenic diet, because they think it gives them a higher level of performance, especially in high-intensity, short-duration sports. Wrong. St. Louis University has done a very good study showing that you may not want to use the ketogenic diet because it doesn't work that way. In fact, the research team found that after following the ketogenic diet, the participants did not perform as well at the exercise task. Quote, in popular discussions, the term ketogenic diet is often used as a broader term for low-carb diets, including Atkins. However, the language is often confused. People often think low-carb and high-protein. This is related but different, as protein can only be a normal level for a true ketogenic diet. The objective of ketogenic diet is to starve the body of carbohydrate. If there is too much protein in the diet, the body will use the protein to make carbohydrates, which defeats the purpose. When the body is sufficiently deprived of carbohydrates, it manufactures ketone bodies as an alternative fuel. It's an emergency backup system that allows us to survive when we are at risk of starvation, but it has side effects. Right now in the general public, it is touted for weight loss. Some studies have shown that it is effective for weight loss. I worry, though, that this may be a lot of smoke and mirrors. A typical diet is 60% carbohydrate. So if you limit carbs, you might find yourself just not eating that much. If you eliminate most food options, you may just be losing weight because you're cutting calories, end quote. A very close friend of mine, personal friend and professional friend, was Dr. Robert Atkins. He was the person who founded this whole movement. He was enormously successful. I believe that his book sold more than 7 million copies. And yet, for all those decades that we were friends, socialized together, go out together, he would have his meat and fat diet at dinner, and I'd have a vegetable plate. And I said, Robert, why don't you come over one day, you pick the day, to my office, and just sit there and hear people talk about the effects of a high-protein, low-carbohydrate, or ketogenic diet, and producing ketones, and what that ketone overload does in the brain, how it creates brain fog, and how all that protein creates ammonia and urea excess, and how the body can't store protein. So you're giving people a lot of protein, but there's only a tiny amount from animal proteins they actually need per meal. In fact, here's the measurement. And I went through I had prepared an analytical chart, and I said, with 20.35 grams to an ounce, and based upon an average serving, even modest, of 6 ounces, here's how many grams of protein. You're giving a person 2 days' worth of protein in one meal from one item. And that's as if they take the small item. Now, all that's creating a byproduct, deamidization, the breakdown of this. So if you gave a person complex carbohydrates from beans and legumes and nuts and seeds, they will have an even blood sugar level. There's no toxins in the blood. They have more energy. They have better fiber. Your meat-based diet and fat has no fiber. So constipation is a common side effect. Here, you're giving up to 50 grams of fiber a day, so their colon is sweeping out debris constantly and creating good probiotic, good bacteria. And he'd listen, and he didn't change anything. But for the athletes in particular, I've trained along with Peter Roth and John Q and Dolores and Buzz Perry and all the coaches. We've had about 40 coaches. We've trained over 30,000 people to do the New York City Marathon. Every single one has finished it. But what's more importantly, when the 20-mile mark came and everybody else was kind of dragging, in fact, we actually see how many people can we pass in the next 6 miles, count them. And people think, wow, did we just pass 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 people? Yep. And one of the reasons is that throughout the race, they were having sustained juices, a combination of green and red vegetable and fruit juice with coconut water and high in electrolytes, and their body blood sugar was normal, and they had complex carbohydrates, and they had a big carbo meal that night, but even in the morning early, they had some carbohydrates in the form of bananas. So their blood sugar was perfect throughout the whole race. It never depleted. Something simple. And when you have 30,000 people over 40 years doing the marathon, you're able to have a pretty good-sized test group. And then you see the people who are on these high-protein diets not realizing, man, where do you think your body's going to get the sugar it needs? Glycogen? Glucose? Glucose you're going to use real quick. By the 10-mile mark, most of your glucose is depleted. Then you're bringing up that glycogen. So we should get off these high-protein diets. Get on a healthy plant-based diet. And for athletes, one of those high plant-based diets contains beets. And beets give you nitric oxide, and that gives you greater oxygen flow to the extremities, including the legs and feet and the brain. From the University of Leeds, which is in the United Kingdom, published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health, a diet rich in fish and legumes can help delay natural menopause. Let me repeat that. If you have a lot of beans and pulses and legumes, like split peas and lentils and black beans, kidney beans, pinto beans, the highest protein, of course, in a bean family is from the soybean, you're getting in a normal cup of beans, you're getting about 7 grams protein. But if you go to soybeans, you're getting up to 25 grams protein. That's half a day requirement. So if I have a soybean salad where I put a can, I rinse the soybeans, and then put it into a salad, make a nice sauce, put in some sea vegetables and other greens, that's an awful lot of perfect protein, and that helps your body. But it especially maintains normal hormone development, and that's good for menopause. So most people are unfortunately eating rice and pastas, these refined carbohydrates. That's bad for you. And several genetic and behavioral and environmental factors are thought to be involved in the timing of menopause. And in this particular study, they looked at 35,000 women between 35 and 69 from England, Scotland, and Wales. And the women then showed that their weight history, their physical activity, reproductive history, and use of hormone replacement therapy, which I'm absolutely totally opposed to, synthetic hormone replacement therapy. Natural hormone replacement therapy, Vitex, Fotai, Dong Quai, yes. But the synthetics, no. And what they found was that the women who ate a healthier diet that was rich in legumes and fish, they had less problems with menopause, substantially less problems with menopause. So remember, when you're eating those legumes, you're getting zinc and vitamin B6. You're getting a lot of the natural hormone stimulators. So vegan diet or vegetarian diet, with or without fish. I've actually done it without fish with a group with phenomenal results. And finally, lycopene. Lyco, L-Y-C-O, peen, P-E-N-E, it is now being looked upon as a new cancer preventative. In fact, evidence published over 30 years ago indicated that people who consumed higher amounts of lycopene had lower site-specific cancer rates. And according to Life Extension, in the past year, an impressive number of studies have been published about how lycopene can slow or impede cancer progression. And these new publications point to a variety of roles for lycopene in colorectal cancer, skin cancer, ovarian cancers, while also shedding new light on its underlying benefits. Now, cancer remains the second leading cause of death among Americans. It affects more than 21 million people at any given time. So it's a big deal worldwide. And that makes chemo prevention with plant extracts like lycopene a necessary add for the diet. So lycopene goes after cancer cells. Why? Because cancer cells share certain properties that make them different from cells in healthy tissue. For example, cancer cells lose the ability to control normal replication. And unlike normal cells, most cancer cells continue to replicate out of control even when they encounter normal cells. And cancer cells are also capable of squeezing through adjoining tissue to cause local invasion or distant metastasis. Well, lycopene is a carotenoid molecule found in tomatoes and watermelon and raspberries and cherries. And it works in all three of those cellular and molecular levels, making it a potential weapon against a wide variety of cancers. And in 2017, a review of the scientific literature on lycopene and colorectal cancer showed that lycopene has specific effects on two key aspects of cancer development. First, proliferation. the rapid and uncontrolled growth of cells that follow a cancer-inducing mutation, and secondly, progression, the events that must occur to keep a growing ball of malignant cells supplied with blood and that permit the tumor mass to invade local tissue or to break away and spread it to distant parts of the body. So lycopene's beneficial effects arise in part because of its ability to interact with signaling pathways that modulate cell growth and replication and death. So for ovarian cancer, for skin cancer, for colorectal cancer, make sure you're getting lots of lycopene each day in the diet. It'll make enormous difference. We're 20 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world and all the syndicated programs that are listening in right now. Thank you. And remember, we've never done any advertising. And I stopped doing interviews in 2000. I'd done hundreds and hundreds, and I just said, enough. If you have something of value to say, get the right people on board and let them spread the message. Well, your word of mouth, sharing articles, documentaries, information each day, that's how we grow. So I want to thank everyone for sharing. And by the way, for those of you who want to download this program because you can't listen to it live, here's a phone number to call in. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. But let's say you're out and about, you're in California, you're in New Mexico, you're in Canada, and you can't be near a land-based station or you can't be near an internet. Just go into your cell phone, call this number, 424-203-8046, 424-203-8046. In the last few days, doing a special in-depth white paper, I discuss two different types of science. One is called evidence-based. The other is called, I wouldn't say that science-based is the dominant theory, but evidence-based has been around for a while. And I actually support evidence-based medicine as evidence-based science. After all, shouldn't we have evidence that something works? Shouldn't we have good science that has researched something and says, yes, this medication, this food is healthy, this food is not good, this water is polluted, this water is safe, this air is okay to breathe, this air has got particulate matter which is damaging. We need evidence-based medicine, which means that they're simply looking for evidence. And in that context and with that mindset, it started off as an ideal, and I fully support this. They were looking for the truth wherever that truth was. Let me give you an example of evidence-based medicine and what it's morphed into and how it's been compromised, how it's been captured by a small group of skeptics who say that only science-based medicine matters, and then watch the pharmaceutical companies and their scientists for hire and academics who are paid then only support one part of science at our detriment. There was a time when the National Cancer Institute and one of its top scientists, Dr. Dean Burke, were looking at nutrition and vitamins, especially vitamin A and vitamin C, and how it would manifest in preventing or reversing cancer. I was so impressed by the work done that I got a call from Dr. Dean Burke, one of the founders of the National Cancer Institute, and I was broadcast on our sister station PFW in Washington for over 33 years, every day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and he would listen. And he said he took a late lunch break because he wanted to hear the show. He said, I think you'll find what we're doing very interesting. So I went down there, and I spoke with him, but also he had been doing work showing how powerful vitamin D and vitamin A and vitamin C were together in cancer with remarkable results. And it was through him that I was introduced to the director of the National Cancer Institute. We had a conversation, and he was very open, very nice man. And he said some of the most important work we've ever done here is looking at ways that are natural that people could use to prevent cancer, firstly, and secondly, the best ways of helping the body if you have cancer. And he said, we have not excluded using, you know, supplements or minerals like zinc or selenium. And he had done a lot of research. He said, we have hundreds of these studies that we've done. Now, I thought that was very important. But also, not long after that, I was introduced to a physician, Dr. Dean Ornish. And Ornish was doing a landmark study. Up until that point, it was dogma that if you had congestion in your heart, if you had, let's say, carotid artery blockage, you had to have coronary bypass or stents or balloon angioplasty, at the same time taking statin drugs and other drugs. And he was showing in this landmark study, which I was down filming, I was the first journalist to actually film him and the participants. I've never played that. I had to play that. I don't know why I never played it, but I will. I'll put it up on our website because I have a couple hours of people I interviewed and him at the time. But it ended up that study was a landmark. He was able to reverse heart disease in these patients of different ages and different types of disease using only a plant-based diet, exercise, and stress management. This would later go on to be heralded as the gold standard. And he published it in the New England Journal of Medicine and also separately in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet. So by every measure, he qualified for evidence-based medicine. He had evidence that a plant-based diet, exercise, stress management worked. He had a large group of people. He reversed their diseases. They had the before and after medical. So he passed every single benchmark of a really good evidence-based medicine. At the same time, Linus Pauling, having worked with a man named Dr. Stone in a separate Dr. Albert Sangiorgi, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering ascorbic acid. Pauling was America's only two-time winner of the Nobel Prize, unshared. I believe Dr. Otto Warburg won the Nobel Prize twice, but I don't know if it was shared. Anyhow, he won it in chemistry as one of them. And so here one of our preeminent scientists was using vitamin C at very high doses, beyond anything we had seen before, for helping with cancer. And he and Dr. Ewan Cameron of the Vale of Leven Hospital in Scotland were able to come up with some very impressive results, especially with terminally ill patients. And he was making the rounds talking about this. And that's good evidence-based medicine. Also, there was a Dr. Robert Cathcart using 50,000 milligrams of vitamin C. I was using 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C with 1,200 persons with full-blown AIDS and HIV infection at the Tri-State Healing Center, getting remarkable results. And that was published widely in the African-American community, and Bill Tatum of the Amsterdam News came down, and here was the medical records. The medical staff, the doctors in the center would hear the records when they came in. Here's a year later, or 16 months later, they have no HIV, they're completely healthy, so we had good evidence-based medicine. So all over the place, people were coming up with really good results. There were at least, at that time, over 60,000 people that you would consider using their practice, their expertise, whether it was a physician using homeopathy or a dentist, taking the mercury fillings out. It was like a renaissance happening. And then in came the attack. That all became pushed aside. And people says, no, that's not good enough. You're talking about yoga helping with health. It doesn't do anything. You're talking about meditation. It doesn't do anything. You're talking about prayer. It does nothing. You're talking about your faith. This means nothing. No. And these were one of the principal architects behind this was an avowed atheist, a militant atheist. So a small group of people who were pretty smart people, they had good backgrounds, they got together and they said that evidence-based medicine is allowing too much of what is not controllable in, and so they went to this very ultra-orthodox procedure, meaning you had to do what they said, and it was almost all pharmaceutical-based. You couldn't criticize medicine. You couldn't criticize the American diet. You couldn't criticize medical procedures. You had to accept that the only way of approaching cancer was no longer the way it originally was produced, and the good results from the National Cancer Institute and Dr. Jory and the others who were there, now it was chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, and nothing else. And to make sure that you got the message, they took two doctors, a Dr. James Privatira in California and a doctor north of him, and they brought him up on charges through the state medical board that they were engaged in fraud. Now, the fraud was not because they were treating cancer. They were not. It was that their patients who had cancer, they were not saying, stick just with chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. What they would do is take a patient who had had chemotherapy or radiation surgery, and they would give them nutrition and everything that the evidence-based medicine had shown will help a person recover faster. So they were brought in and lost their medical license. And Privatira in particular was sent to work on a chain gang at hard labor. Of the 250-plus patients who came to testify that they were helped because of his nutrition advice, and not one of them was hurt, the judge allowed none of that. Are you using science-based medicine, current scientific standards? And if he said yes, that meant he would have had to say he's advocating chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, or using it. But he wasn't. He was advocating for a healthy diet for those who had already had the science-based medicine approach. I only found out when his wife came to me and asked, would I help? And I was on WMCA at the time, and I used our audience and my large syndicated audience. I was syndicated all over America. And we managed to get a petition going, and we managed finally, after a half year, to get him out of prison. Carl Humiston was also attacked, Harvard grad, board certified, really nice man, great doctor. He lost his license. And then within a period of a few years, dozens of doctors who were helping their patients get well using evidence-based medicine that allowed for anything that was proven to work was replaced and swept out the door with science-based medicine that a small group of people controlled, and behind those people were the pharmaceutical industry. So here's the takeaway message. Do we need proof that something works to try it? You bet. Does science-based medicine have the absolute proof? Well, look at Vioxx. That's science-based medicine. It killed a minimum of 60,000 Americans, but some now say that figures upwards of 500,000. Nobody was punished, not even the company, Merck, that made it. Look at the synthetic hormone replacement therapy that has adverse reactions, including heart attack, stroke, colon cancer, breast cancer, and dementia in 13% of the women using. There are 10 million women using it. It's 1.3 million women a year we're sacrificing to science-based medicine. It's ultra-orthodox. I'm a scientist. I'm a clinical nutritionist. I'm a licensed dietitian. I'm a PhD in public health science and human nutrition. I'm a research fellow with over 100 studies that I have done at the Institute of Applied Biology, some landmark. And yet, I'm looking for what works. And if I can show that something works, and it brings a new dimension of understanding to evidence-based medicine, that's what I'm interested in. But everything I will do will be rejected and called quackery, and yet everything I do ends up being by true science. Let me give an example. Then we're going to go to our guest in a moment. I've done over 40 clinical studies. To my knowledge, that's most of any human being in the United States on health and nutrition, meaning with no medical input, people were selected. Let's just say arthritis. To get into the study, you had to have medical proof from your doctor that you had arthritis for a minimum of 3 years. It turns out the average was 7 years. You had to be on medication and with no improvement and getting worse. This was medically supervised by a board-certified physician, and I gave them only a 28-day protocol where they had to be on a very specific diet, a vegan diet with certain specific supplements and amounts every day, a certain amount of exercise, a certain amount of stress management. Every single day they had to journal it, and all their medical records were before and after. At the end of 28 days, we filmed them on the first day, we filmed them on the last day. We had a 93% reversion of all arthritic symptoms or improvements to the degree that a person was fully mobile, including a man who had arthritis so bad that he could hardly walk, used a cane, and had to take his time getting up and down the steps at 92nd Street and 2nd Avenue where we had the center, and he was without a cane and had full mobility and no pain. Now that is a gold standard. Now, to make sure it works, you duplicate it again, and then you publish in a peer-reviewed journal, and you take this before the scientific community and say, here's what I've discovered. You should get the same results using my results and my protocol. That's how it should work. But that's not what science-based medicine is. They don't have double-blind, placebo-controlled studies. For example, they'll tell you to trust them, take a vaccine, take all these vaccines, they're safe and effective, yet the very ingredients in their vaccines have been shown by every toxicology textbook to be toxic per se individually. Now imagine putting them all together into a synergistic toxic cocktail. They'll say there's no association between vaccines and most injuries, and yet 3 million parents would beg to differ with you. They say that it's been tested in their 14 studies. A, they don't have a single double-blind placebo-controlled study. Evidence-based medicine would have 10,000 young children with no vaccines, 10,000 children with complete vaccines, cross-matching for age and ethnicity, and then every 6 months you check to see what has happened. At the end of 5 years, you can say, all right, the group that received no vaccines had X, the group that received the vaccines had X or Y, and now we know which one works. They have no such study. But evidence-based medicine would do that study. Science-based medicine will never do a study that jeopardizes its positioning of product or protocol in the marketplace. It's market-driven. So science-based medicine today is a purely capitalist, neoliberal process of pathologizing people and profiting from it. Evidence-based medicine, good medicine that we need, says if yoga is shown in multiple studies to lessen your pain, we'll use yoga. Today, there are thousands upon thousands of studies in the peer-reviewed literature. We cite them every single day on this program that shows you evidence-based medicine works. And yet, the very thing we tell you works, with a random back smack of the hand, the entire skeptical movement and its science-based medicine association with orthodoxy says none of it works. None of it? Are you saying that body-mind medicine with more than 3,000 studies published in the journals of psychoneuroimmunology and epigenetic journals, none of that works? Yoga doesn't work? They say that all of Chinese medicine doesn't work. Ayurvedic medicine doesn't work. They say that no holistic medicine works. Chiropractic doesn't work. Homeopathy doesn't work. Herbs don't work. Organic diets don't work. Plant-based diets don't work. So I asked them, what is your expertise? I have expertise. What is yours? I've done clinical studies. You haven't. And yet they're the ones that the New York Times, CNN, will have on as experts. So it's no longer about evidence being needed to prove something works. It's about politics and economics capturing and betraying real science. So you, public, have been betrayed. You've been manipulated. You've been lied to. Because the good scientists, and there are many good scientists, and the good physicians, and the good practitioners, the good chiropractors, the good homeopaths, the naturopaths, the holistic dentists and nurses and doctors, the holistic vets whose cats and dogs aren't over-vaccinated and live longer, these are the people still practicing evidence-based medicine and health care. And yet, our attention's been drawn away, and they've been labeled with quackery, charlatans, frauds, for healing people and doing it right. Just think about that. Let's now go over to my guest standing by in Illinois. Thank you for your patience, Professor Francis Boyle. Nice to have you with us today.
Happy to be on, and my best to your audience.
And by the way, Professor Boyle, who I gave you his bio earlier, he's written many papers in law reviews and many books. The most recent publication is Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law. He also wrote Biowarfare and Terrorism and the Tamil Genocide in Sri Lanka. Professor, Palestinians in Gaza have been staging their peaceful Great March and for return for over a month now, and reports continue to come in almost daily of Israeli snipers shooting unarmed demonstrators, including children and two journalists who died. All these people died. 50 have been murdered so far. 7,000 people have been shot or wounded, and half of those with live ammunition. And there's been no Israeli casualties or injuries. Israel now has an open fire policy, supposedly only to aim at demonstrators' legs, and the deaths are being called accidents. Moreover, the Israeli government has been framing the march as Hamas riots, but there seems to be no confirmatory evidence for this whatsoever. And these are solely civilian demonstrators by human beings living in deplorable, uncivilized conditions in an apartheid ghetto, which Israel has created in Gaza. The demonstrations which follow Gandhian peace activism is primarily being held to draw world attention to Gazan humanitarian plight. As I understand it, the march is planned to conclude on May 15th, when perhaps tens of thousands of Palestinians will charge to the guarded border. And one can almost imagine a reenactment of Gandhi's salt march, except instead of beating peaceful protesters with batons, this will be live ammunition. And there is no condemnation, not whatsoever, of Israel's actions in our mainstream media, or in the House, or the Senate, or the White House, or anyone in Washington, D.C., for that matter. And this is deplorable. And moreover, our new Secretary of State that I mentioned earlier, Mike Pompeo, has fully endorsed Israel's open fire actions. So, Professor Boyle, please update us about what you know as the underlying motivation for this Palestinian march, and why has the international community been so silent? And isn't this another case of a Zionist attempt to ethnically cleanse the soil Palestinians to enlarge Israel? The forum is yours.
Well, that's a very good introduction, Gary. And I think we all have to be extremely concerned about May 15th. This is going to be a perfect storm, as that movie had it, for the Palestinians. The Great Return March will culminate with them trying to storm the fence. It will be the start of Ramadan, which Muslims believe is auspicious for martyrdom. It will be Nakba Day, starting this whole situation back in 1948. The 70th anniversary, when, as you correctly pointed out, over 700,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed out of Palestine by the Zionists. On May 15, The United States has chosen deliberately to move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which clearly violates international law. It also appears that there will be large numbers of American dignitaries on hand in Jerusalem on May 15. And even President Trump said he might come. So I right now shudder to think how many Palestinians are going to be murdered, in fact, genocided by Zionists on May 15. And you had mentioned Gandhi. It reminds me of the essay Gandhi wrote about that the Jews should use his satyagraha against the Nazis. And that's really what is going on here. The civilians in Gaza are all protected by the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. They're simply being murdered, shot down like dead, like dogs in the street. So anything could happen May 15, Gary. I really don't know what to say. But in the essay I sent you and a lecture I gave here, which you might want to put on your website, I can send you the lecture. I sent your assistant there the published version. If you add it all up, since 1948, the Zionists have been inflicting outright genocide against the Palestinians in violation of the 1948 genocide, and with the full complicity of the United States government that is prohibited and also criminalized by the Genocide Convention itself, and also with the complicity of Zionists all over the world, especially here in the United States, where you see all the leaders of the major Zionist organizations in America lining up and applauding and supporting what Israel is doing, the Israeli genocide against the Palestinians, and preventing Congress, the mainstream news media, from saying anything at all about it because of their long-time terror threats, bullying, and intimidation of anyone who criticizes Israel for any reason. And I certainly have been subjected to that since I entered Harvard in 1971. So there's nothing new about this. It's been going on at least that long, maybe longer, but that's when I first began to publicly speak out for the Palestinians. I had studied the matter in college, and then when I got to Harvard, spoke out for them. I suspect I was the only student at that time publicly speaking out for the Palestinians. So here I am.
Yeah, just this week, the Israeli parliament passed a bill that gives Netanyahu full power to wage war without a cabinet vote. He'll now only need the approval of the defense minister, who is now a hard right-wing ideologue and a warmonger, Lieberman. It would appear that Israel now has the unobstructed green light to use the U.S. government and our allies to do as it pleases the Middle East and to militarily eliminate its foes. And it believes that there is no obstacle now in its path. In South Lebanon, Israel covets its water resources and is eager to annex that region, and it's targeting Syria and Iran with U.S. permission. So how dangerous is this recent move to give Netanyahu such power? And can you make any predictions, even best guesstimates, on how the prime minister and Lieberman might act on that, knowing that they will only get support from France, Great Britain, Germany, and the United States. And they're up against people in Saudi Arabia, and they will probably engage in war with Iran. Had Hillary Clinton been elected, we already, I believe, would be seeing a war with Israel against Iran. So when they go after Iran, they're going to probably have to use some form of nuclear devices. What do you see this as a possibility of happening, and when?
Well, right, Gary. They're already waging, Israel's already waging war against Iran in Syria right now as we speak. They've been bombing and attacking bases over there with Iranian troops and killing them knowingly. Iran is in Syria at the request of the government of Syria, pursuant to the right of collective self-defense under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, applicable to both Syria and Iran. And they are there because, as you correctly pointed out, Obama and Mrs. Clinton unleashed 50,000 or so jihadi terrorists against the Syrian government in violation of international law in an attempt to overthrow it. Exactly what they did in Libya to the Gaddafi government there as well, both Gaddafi and the Assad father, son, Saddam Hussein. These were all secular nationalist Arab governments that stood in the pathway of the United States and Israel dominating and controlling that region. So in turn, we use these Islamic jihadis that we used going back to invading Afghanistan under the Carter-Brzezinski administration and have unleashed them over there. So, sure, if this keeps going the way it is, that whole area could blow up, and it could blow up starting May 15. We could see a major slaughter, genocidal slaughter, of Palestinians by Israel with the full support of the United States government and the Zionist-controlled and dominated news media here in the United States. I've dealt with Israeli officials at times at the highest levels, and all they really care about is public opinion here in the United States and the position of the United States government. And as long as they have us in their pocket, which they believe they do, they figure they can do whatever they want to. And so, yes, you could have war between Israel, Syria, Iranian forces in Syria, attacks on Russian forces in Syria, attacks on Hezbollah, in Lebanon, South Lebanon. Yes, they've always desired the Litani River headwaters because their country is parched of water. And what little water they have, they steal from the Palestinian aquifers. In addition, you have these Jewish fundamentalists who repeatedly are attacking El-Aqsa Mosque on the Dome of the Rock, then the Dome of the Rock on Haram al-Sharif, and trying to destroy the mosque and build their so-called Third Temple. So, you know, if that happens, any of this, yeah, that whole region could blow up. You are correct that an attack upon Iran would itself would require the use of nuclear weapons. This has been threatened before, both, you know, by the United States and Israel. And I think you're right. If Mrs. Clinton had been elected president, certainly we'd be at war with Russia today. Iran, I don't know. But in any event, there we are. The whole region could blow up May 15. And then repeatedly, Israel has planned another round of ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians, like they did in 1948, the Nakba, like they did in 1968, the Naxa, and drive as many Palestinians out as they possibly can get away with under the cover of ongoing hostilities with surrounding states. So that could happen too, sure.
Well, let us keep an eye on this because the mainstream media has its interests and priorities elsewhere. My goal is to see peace for the Jewish people and peace for the Palestinian people. And I believe that we have to have people involved who are not ideologues or simply a partisan on one side or the other, because then all you're going to have is conflict. And we're just not being honest about what the real solutions are, I believe. But I thank you very much for all your decades of work on helping those who are oppressed throughout the world. Much appreciated.
Well, thank you, Garen. You are correct. The United States has never been an honest broker here. I have been at the Middle East peace negotiations from sponsored by Bush Sr. In Washington, D.C. I advise both the Palestinians and the Syrians, and we could have had peace then. I was drafting documents for both Palestinians and Syrians, but Israel rejected it, and the Bush administration did not force them to accept reasonable proposals put forth by the Palestinians and the Syrians, and it's been that way ever since. So there we are. But we could have had peace. I was there. I saw it. I could have drafted those documents myself. And it is correct that it's on the U.S. side, American Jews have always been in charge of this so-called peace process, going back to 1991, where you had Ross, Kurzer, Miller. And now today you have Jared Kushner, Greenblatt, and Friedman. So, you know, how are you really going to negotiate peace here when successive U.S. governments going back to 1991 under Bush Sr. And continuing through all of them up until today have just put American Jews and Zionists, some of them Orthodox, in charge of the process. So there we are today. I don't know what to say, but May 15 is not going to be good for anyone, and especially for the Palestinians. I'm afraid they'll be subjected to outright genocide and another round of ethnic cleansing, a total catastrophe, perhaps another Nakba. We'll have to see.
Thank you very much for being on today, Professor Francis Boyle. We look forward to our next conversation.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. We're at the end of another program. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.